They passed a bluff that burned perpetually, eternally, 24/7, and stank of sulfur and brimstone, and long stretches of grass so finely manicured you could play ninepins on them. Enormous flocks of white cranes flew high above. They knew so little about how the world worked. They were relieved to see storm fronts moving west to east, just as they did in Virginia. They were alive at a time when there were migrations of green and yellow parrots so vast that, flying at 60 miles an hour, it might take 2 full days for a flock to pass overhead.
That's Michael Pritchett, featured writer today on Unbridled Aloud. I'm Kay Callison. The voice is that of Bill Lewis, a high school history teacher who's writing a novel about Lewis and Clark. He's telling of some of the mysteries and wonders that they encountered on their voyage of discovery up the Missouri River, looking for the Northwest Passage. The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis, a novel of Lewis and Clark, is Michael Pritchett's debut novel. We'll talk more about this later, but from the top, we need to explain that Melancholy Fate is a novel within a novel, so to speak, with structural and thematic parallels that are positively uncanny at times. The common thread is this. Bill Lewis, a happily married father who nonetheless struggles with major depression, is trying to figure out why Meriwether Lewis, the great American hero who successfully led an expedition so dangerous that no one expected them to live to tell the tale about it, took his own life just 3 years later at Grinders Inn on the Natchez Trace. His dying words, "Oh, madam, give me some water, for I am so strong, and it is so hard to die." So in The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis, we read the novel from history that Bill Lewis is writing alongside the novel about Bill Lewis writing his novel. And the beauty lies in the remarkable lucidity with which Pritchett delivers the two storylines, neither of which can be fully understood and appreciated except in the context of the other. Like Bill Lewis, Michael Pritchett lives in Kansas City, Kansas, and he teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's also the author of an award-winning collection of short fiction, The Venus Tree. Here he is, reading from early on in the Lewis and Clark parts of the novel. The day before, they'd come across the aftermath of what must have been a tornado, and I quote, "Around a bend, in all directions, trees 4 feet thick lay on the ground, snapped off as if by the detonation of a bomb."
In the morning, it was discovered Reed hid his things outside camp the night before, collected them, and departed. Sergeant Floyd came to Lewis's tent with the news, red-faced, in a fury, white spit in the corners of his mouth, and shaking. "Take 2 men and locate him and shoot him on the spot," Lewis ordered, not meeting Floyd's wide-eyed gape. Clark, standing nearby, said nothing, in poignant disapproval. But if the policy lacked compassion for the souls of the flock, Lewis reasoned, it at least kept it together in one place. And since his own commanders had done thusly, so would he too. The next day, a white feather came tumbling and rolling over and over in the current. Lewis sighted it at a quarter mile while talking to Clark about the desertion, and could not look away from it. It approached. He reached and snagged it, nearly going overboard, saved by Clark, who guessed his action a moment beforehand. Clark's man, York, came to see what prize, golden treasure, and Lewis gave it him, all unconcerned, and noted more feathers rocking on the flood, 12, no more. Then the river was white with feathers. Shore to shore, the water turned to feathers, and the boat pressed upward in a fast, rasping current of feathers. Sergeant Floyd, at the helm, turned. "Captain!" His face was fevered and red, and an orange plume hung down from above his head, surrounding him. Lewis glimpsed it from the corner of his eye, but it vanished when looked at straight. Clark allowed the feathers to tumble, rush, and bump under his submerged palm. Lewis didn't try to estimate the number because none could possibly believe him. Then they passed out of it, the blanket changing to a veil, then a loose woven net, and at last the river again.
Sergeant Floyd held his side at the place where they wounded Christ the Lord. And a sudden flush afflicted Lewis, an all-over blanching, a sinking of the organs, nauseated terror and blackness at the edges of his sight. For York's hand no longer gripped the feather. But no, there it was in the other, which now made a gesture as if to discard it. Lewis's dry voice, like wood ripping, broke out. "No, I will have that, York." The men all looked at him, and at York. York looked into Lewis's eyes appraisingly. York, a remarkable example of his kind, noted something amiss in this, Lewis knew, but gave it over. Later, Lewis would count this as the first day he was certain that the thing which gripped him in times past was laying hold once more. "What on earth?" Clark said, turning to see the flood of feathers, though it was already gone around the next bend. "What, Clark? Have you not seen 2 miles of feathers before? How doth it compare, in your opinion, to the talking fish of day before yesterday?" But they were sent to find marvelous things. Mastodons and saber-toothed lions, the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and a river running deep and clear to the Pacific through a neat cleft in a tiny row of pebbles called the Rock Mountains. He was to look for Hebrew hieroglyphs and try out Yiddish words on the tribes. And one question in particular continued to revisit him. Was suicide, and especially suicide from love, as common among them as in white polite society? His mind hung up on that inquiry. He examined it, vague and advancing dread.
Michael Pritchett, reading from The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis. I'm Kay Callison. In an author's note at the end of the novel, Pritchett tells us that essentially the whole inspiration for Melancholy Fate was the daily journals of the expedition, some 2 million words worth, most of them personally written by Lewis and Clark. I asked Pritchett what led him to the journals in the first place.
A friend of mine, poet Trish Reeves, she used a epigraph from the journals for the title of the novel that she was writing at the time. And I got interested in reading the journals, and I just started making check marks by all the things that seemed to be, I don't know, sort of foretelling what was going to happen to Lewis after the expedition, which was that he was going to go into sort of a tailspin and that he wasn't going to live long after the expedition.
Mm. Is it generally known that Lewis took his own life?
No, it's, I would say about one out of every two people who I talked to found that to be a big shock, that he had not survived long after the expedition, and that Clark's life had actually gone the other way. He'd just become this prosperous gentleman who married and had children and lived on the success of the expedition for the rest of his life. And Lewis just did not. He just could not seem to put together any kind of a life for himself.
Are there still historians who quarrel with that conclusion that, in fact, he took his own life?
Yes. Yes, there are. And I think that there was, for a long time, a real reluctance to believe that an American hero would kill himself.
Mm.
I think that for a long time, was viewed as the coward's way out, since Lewis was clearly not a coward. Had led this big expedition, that couldn't be the answer. But the two people who never doubted that it was suicide were Thomas Jefferson, who Lewis worked with every day in the White House, and Clark, who was his best friend.
Was that part of your motive for writing this novel? Did you want to debunk this idea of the ideal hero?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we try to hold our public figures to a higher standard of, I guess, mental health and wellness and normal behavior than is really feasible a lot of the time, and is probably a higher standard than we would hold even ourselves to, given the same circumstances, and don't simply allow them to be fallible human beings.
Mm-hmm. Both Grace Paley and Tobias Wolff have said that they know they have a real story going only when they find the story within the story. And that's what we have in this novel. Was that true for you, too?
Yes. I think that I tried to write the novel as a purely historical novel and tried three drafts of it that way, and it just wasn't quite coming together because there was just so many mysteries that I sort of felt like I needed a detective, a sleuth of some kind in the story who would be investigating all of these mysteries. And that's kind of how Bill came into the story. Was as a guy who was looking at the same facts that I was looking at and having the same kind of sort of puzzlement and wonder about all of these fantastic things that all sort of coincided and intersected with each other at the same moment in history.
Well, the historical parts of the novel are the novel Bill Lewis is writing, right?
That's correct.
Okay, then who's writing Bill's story?
That's a good question. I think that the reader has become such a sophisticated reader these days that writers can begin to experiment in various ways with storytelling. And the reader is so sophisticated that they can follow the experiment. They can piece together a narrative that can be, you know, incredibly complicated, one that may be a story within a story within a story. And not only do they not get lost, but I think they actually sort of enjoy the ride.
Absolutely. To what extent is Bill Lewis a persona for you?
Yeah, Bill and I certainly have a number of things in common. And I think that something really interesting has happened in the past few years with postmodernism. And in postmodernism, writing a novel much more these days involves not only writing the novel, but telling the story of writing the novel. And postmodernism is very interested in the process of storytelling, almost more than it's interested in telling the story. And so I think that I did want someone in the story, like Bill, who would be suffering and struggling and trying to piece this story together in the way that a novelist does. And I guess I also wanted to show sort of the absurd, the desperate, kind of hysterical personality of a writer. The writer always feels like they're on the verge of insanity, and yet around them, their normal lives, going to work, keeping up marriage, taking care of their kids, all of that continues while they're also going through this kind of crazed, neurotic state.
And that's interesting in this case because it parallels the story of clinical depression. Characteristically, people who are horribly depressed, they do everything they can, like Lewis does, to hide it. And Bill, too. So ultimately, after you've finished this now and looking at this novel as the author, whose story is this, do you think?
I think ultimately it's the story of being an American male, sort of down through history, sort of the struggle to meet sometimes the absurd and opposite expectations of being a man in modern times and in Lewis's time, and how there are actually a lot of people who are not doing this very well or dealing with it very well. And I really wanted to sort of explore why there are so many guys that aren't dealing with this very well, who are turning to drugs and sex and food and all kinds of different things in order to try to cope.
So ultimately, would you say that the novel belongs to both of them equally and one can't be seen except in relation to the other?
Yes, I think that's exactly the way I would put it. I just did not see the novel really having much relevance without Bill and Lewis being in the story together. I really felt like we probably know all we're going to know about the historical version of Lewis, and that what I wanted to do was I wanted to juxtapose the historical Lewis against a modern guy and see what that could show us about our own present-day culture and how we're faring, basically, whether the pressures have, have changed any, whether the pressures make sense, whether there's some way to change the expectations so that more guys can feel like they are meeting these expectations and don't suffer these terrible depressions.
Michael Pritchett talking about the melancholy fate of Captain Lewis. I'm Kay Callison. Here's a scene from the Bill Lewis storyline that addresses some of the things we've been talking about. Bill and his wife Emily, who by the way is frantic about their 14-year-old son Henry's anorexia, are on a float trip on one of the tributaries talked about in the journals. They're with four other people they've never met before. Russ is their tour guide.
They gathered around the fire with their glasses to eat the steaks with truffle butter that Russ doled out from a margarine tub, and roasted rosemary potatoes, and one hell of a nice trifle for dessert. Emily ate barely half her steak and mulled one bite of potato in her mouth, then spat it into her napkin. But nobody turned down a refill on wine. Soon her eyes were on fire from the inside, and a high basted color came into her face. She laid her head on his thigh and gazed into the fire. "Didn't they eat a lot of dog on the trail?" Leslie asked. "Lewis preferred it to anything, but Clark wouldn't touch it," he said. "They were hungry in the winter. One time they ate their candles. Another time, starving dogs crawled into camp and ate up all their moccasins. I know it's supposed to be a proud moment or whatever, but I find the whole thing kind of sad," Rita said. "I agree, like with the buffalo and everything," Jasmine said. "How they were all gone in just a few years." "No, I mean everything about it," Rita said. "Every last thing." "I bet they got a lot of action on the trail," Pablo said. "If the captains did, somebody cut it from the accounts," he said. "The men hooked up frequently with the native women, and that was treated as no big deal. Except for this one time, when somebody's husband caught his wife coming in late and stabbed her three times." "Sounds like a big deal," Emily said. "True," he said. "But don't some diplomatic practices do terrible violence to the individuals involved?" Jasmine, who was tough, nodded matter-of-factly. "Of course, women were generally tough now, in the new century, and had few illusions. The male-dominated power structure was toppling more easily than expected. Men were letting women into everything now, pulling back every curtain, sort of sheepishly, to reveal, ta-da, nothing much. A box of Playboys, a few French ticklers they bought one time at a truck stop. Surprise! No dripping female corpses hanging from the rafters. Oh well." Russ topped up their wine. Emily's breathing on Lewis's thigh was causing a slow glowing tumescence to develop. "Lewis killed himself, didn't he?" Leslie said. "Do I remember that, or am I making it up?" "That's tragic," Rita said. "Please, that's not tragic. Tragic is wringing hands and tearing clothes," Pablo said. "Tragic is everybody laid out dead at the end on a bloody stage." "Maybe tragedy isn't that obvious now," Bill said. "Maybe it's quieter and it hides better." "Bill, read us something," Emily said, "from the journals." His copy of the journals did happen to be on top of his pack, full of post-its, swollen up to twice its size. Bill held the book. The expedition truly got underway in May 1804, with three cheers from the small party on shore at St. Charles, Missouri. They soon met Daniel Boone, then turned north along with the river just west of what had become Independence. They just missed a detachment of Spanish troops sent up from Santa Fe to intercept them. But the really weird part was who'd sent it. One General James Wilkinson, chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, and a Spanish spy known as Agent 13. He'd later be linked to a plot by Aaron Burr, Tom's vice president, to divide the Union, seize the western U.S. and Mexico, and set himself up as emperor of a new nation called Burrania, with his daughter Theodosia by his side. And if anything about this filial tie seemed improper, then that explains the despicable opinion Alexander Hamilton voiced about Burr, and why Burr called Hamilton out in July 1804 and killed him. it was all kind of crazy how it all intersected, with Lewis in there somewhere too, corresponding with Theo within a month of his death. Bill read aloud from the part where Lewis went out hunting, a day he got chased by a grizzly, almost pounced on by a lynx, and charged by three buffalo, all within an hour's time, which rattled Lewis so, he thought it must be an enchantment or a dream. Would we like this guy? Pablo asked. Would we invite him to pull up a stump? I don't know, he said. A friend of his said he was stiff, bow-legged, without grace, and that he reminded you of Napoleon. Sounds like my ex, Leslie said ruefully, blinking at the fire. Sounds like everybody's ex, Rita said. I've got more about Lewis and the Virginians from various sources, he said. Washington Irving wrote a story in which he called them, let's see here, a pack of lazy, louting, dram-drinking, cockfighting, horse-racing, slave-driving, tavern-haunting, Sabbath-breaking, mulatto-breeding upstarts. I thought they were heroes, Russ said. I mean, that's what I was taught. How come he never married? Rita asked. By now she was looking fairly gorgeous in the firelight. And just why did women have to be so beautiful? Why did the desire for them not only not diminish with time, but actually get worse and worse? Meanwhile, Emily lay on him. Maybe he seemed doomed, he said. He had his chances, but maybe he scared them all away. I don't buy that, Jasmine said. Doomed is sexy as hell. Doomed means you won't hang around and get fat and boring. He nodded. It certainly was a mystery, not unlike the New World itself.
Michael Pritchett, reading from The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis, I'm Kay Callison. Let's rejoin our conversation with questions I had about Bill's quest to understand Meriwether Lewis's depression in light of his own experience and understanding of the illness. Given what we now know about the biological basis for major mental illness, and Bill Lewis knows it too, he's on meds, did that present a challenge for you in writing a novel about somebody trying to figure out why Meriwether Lewis took his own life, and for that matter, about Bill Lewis and his depression?
I think that my own familiarity with depression was really what informed my writing of the physical experience of both Bill and of Meriwether Lewis.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is, why would Bill Lewis need to know why Meriwether Lewis killed himself, when he knows himself it's a biological brain disease?
Right. I think that Bill knows that his problem with depression is partly biological, but I think that he also is looking at the circumstances of his life and realizing that it has also been circumstantial. And I think that Bill's fascination, and almost sort of a morbid fascination with Lewis, is that he has a real fear that this could be him, and he wants to get to the bottom of it so that he can figure out at what point Lewis might have taken a turn for the better, and this might not have had to happen to him. And I don't know, ultimately I think he concludes, after studying Lewis's story, that given the time, given the circumstances of Lewis's life, there really was no way for Lewis to avoid this, that this was simply his fate.
Mm.
And I think Bill is looking at that whole question, too, of whether he believes in fate and whether he feels that he is fated to end in the same bad way that Lewis did.
Another interesting thing that happens with both Lewis and Bill Lewis is that Bill Lewis admires women. He feels more affinity with women than with men. And yet women also represent quite the opposite.
Yeah, Bill realizes that this fascination that he has with women is, you know, in a way it's a more evolved point of view. He sees women as representing good as opposed to viewing them as inferior creatures. But that's an unfortunate point of view for him to take, because what it means is that it isolates him from his own sex.
Mm-hmm.
causes him to pursue women constantly as sort of this manifestation of the superior creature. And it makes it impossible for him to really see women as fallible human beings, as something that if he reaches out to take it, is going to destroy everything that he has.
Mm-hmm. I take it there is indication in the journals that Meriwether Lewis also had a similar feel for women.
Yeah, Lewis definitely pays a lot of attention to women on the expedition. And anytime they encounter a woman, he notes it and he describes her or describes them and how they are treated, whether they are treated as equal or inferior, and really does view Sacagawea as being a superior kind of creature, somebody who is unlike any woman that he's ever encountered before in terms of just her self-mastery.
Is there anything in the journals to suggest that Lewis was in fact in love with Sacagawea?
I would say the two things in the journals that pointed me that way. One was the many admiring remarks that he makes about her, and how he's constantly noting her ability to find food for them in all kinds of dire situations. And the other side of that is this sort of profound hatred he develops toward her husband, how he's constantly noting his neglect of her, his mistreatment of her, and his just general distaste for Charbonneau as a human being. He had unusual feelings for her.
Let's talk about the Enlightenment.
Okay,
we think of Lewis and Clark's voyage of discovery as the quintessential American project of the Enlightenment, the fruit of Jefferson's vision, even as a bona fide philosopher. He was the only American accepted into that company of thinkers at the time.
Right.
So what is Lewis's problem with this point of view? He says the Enlightenment, in fact, never happened, and so does Bill Lewis. What's the deal here?
The interesting thing about Jefferson and his whole generation is that they were viewed as the first post-Enlightenment generation. And scientifically, they were much more enlightened thinkers than the previous generation had been. But at the same time, when Jefferson meets with, I believe it's the 49 assembled Native American chiefs from the West, his remarks to them, he basically says, "We realize it's difficult to have us occupying your territory. We're sorry to take your lands away from you, but you shouldn't resist us. You should allow this to happen because we all have guns and we all know how to use them."
Wow.
And so you have this Enlightenment figure basically saying to all of these chiefs, either go along with this or we're going to kill you all, which shows the hand of the Enlightenment at that point. That it calls itself the Enlightenment in terms of being representing science and rational thought. But at the same time, when it's really threatened, it falls back on the old, what the Spanish referred to as the unquestionable right of conquest.
Right, and Lewis goes off thinking he's going off to find a way to relieve the suffering of humanity. But he's in the same military model.
That's right. That's the bizarre paradox of the time, is that he's been sent off on this diplomatic mission, and yet the money for this mission came out of the War Department's budget and was run by the military, organized by the military, and used military discipline and hierarchy and all of those things, so that you have this, what is really a military mission, which is calling itself a scientific expedition.
The other thing that Lewis says more than once is just heartbreaking and also so ironic in terms of the Enlightenment. He says, "I have made finite the infinite, sir. I made the locality of dreams into places on maps."
Yeah. I think that Lewis realizes what is happening underneath the surface of the Enlightenment, which is that a lot of the mystery and beauty is being taken out of the world by charting everything and measuring everything and mapping everything. That it's going to have an impact on our ability to to dream and to hope and to aspire to various things.
Yes, every step they took on a voyage of discovery, they were destroying what they were discovering. What a thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shocking thing that I think explorers all come to, is the realization that as soon as you lay eyes on something, it is no longer the undiscovered thing that it was. And a certain amount of its life and mystery has been instantly destroyed.
In your author's note, you say that if you're quoting directly from the journals or from letters or something like that of what historical characters say, you put it in quotation marks. Does that mean that much of the dialogue which shows up in quotation marks, in fact, you have found that language in the journals or in letters?
Yeah, I would say that a lot of the language in the book is, the phrasing anyway, is borrowed from the journals and from the letters.
The lines that they say?
Some of them, yes.
But those are good lines.
Oh, they're great lines. Yeah. I sometimes did change the context. I tried to be somewhat true to the spirit and the moment at which something was said. But in a way, I put all of that in there because I knew that Lewis and Clark scholars would read this book. And I wanted to, you know, make a nod to them and show them that I had done my homework, that I had read all of this stuff. I did know that Lewis and Clark scholars would recognize a line and go, oh, wow, there's a line that's actually from a letter by Jefferson from 8 years earlier.
My goodness.
Yes, I'd never undertaken anything like this. It was an exhausting process of pulling all the lines out of things and organizing them into a novel and then fitting it all together so that it all worked.
Wow, that's amazing. Beyond sending the reader to the journals of Lewis and Clark, what's another thing that you would like to send the reader out to or have them take away from this novel?
I wouldn't want Lewis or Bill to be viewed self-pitying kind of guys. I think that the main thing that I wanted to show about both of them is that they have real difficulties with the expectations that are being placed on them by the people around them. And also that they're both suffering from mental illnesses, which they didn't ask for. So I would want people to try to look at both Bill and Meriwether Lewis as objectively as possible and try to understand the illness that they have, that it doesn't make them behave necessarily like ideal human beings, but that we have to, with human beings, take the bitter with the sweet, and that's reality, that's American history.
Well, Michael Pritchett, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kay. It was a real pleasure.
Michael Pritchett talking about his debut novel, The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis, a novel of Lewis and Clark. This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with include Margaret Cesare Thompson, Pamela Thompson, and our old friend Mark Estrin. For more information about The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis and other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including a long list of literary links and book study guides for most of their titles. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.